This is a quick overview of Genesis chapter 1, What Does the Text Say? By Robert C. Newman. Very quick abstract. We go through the text of Genesis 1 and the first few verses of Genesis 2, trying to take a look at what the text actually does say and what it doesn't say, and a little bit about the possible variety of interpretation that could be made in various particular points. So that's basically what we want to try and do here. The text of Genesis 1 is really very simple, but the various views of how to interpret it read in a lot between the lines, so to speak. This includes both the traditional interpretation of Genesis 1 as well as the modern ones, both conservative and liberalizing. We will point up some of these as we go along. So, Genesis 1 and a few verses of Genesis chapter 2 from the English Standard Version. This is Genesis 1, 1 and 2. So, 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Clearly, the passage here speaks of a beginning, but a number of interpreters have translated it differently and made this a introductory clause to the next verse, something like, in the beginning when God created the heavens and the earth was without form, etc. That's not the way I would go, based on the translation made into Greek, what we call the Septuagint, made perhaps 3 centuries B.C., and the allusion to this passage in John chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning was Word, and Word was with God. I would go with the traditional translation of this here. Verse 2, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. What does this phrase, without form and void, mean? All the other occurrences here are not in a creation context, and they typically mean things like an empty wasteland or something of that sort. What is the deep? The Spirit of God was, the darkness was over the face of the deep. The use of that in non-creation passages typically means something like the waters of the sea or the ocean, and sometimes deep waters that are under the ground in connection probably with springs and wells and things of that sort. Genesis 1, 3, and 4, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. A question might be raised here, is this the first light in the universe? Does the Genesis account pick up with the first time there's light? That's the traditional reading of it, and also the reading of some of your modern interpreters who take the light here to be the Big Bang, if you like. my own view, and some others, would go with a light being somewhat further along in the event. Here I would take it when the sun first begins to glow. We'll come back and see about that when we actually look at the material in my PowerPoint talk, Genesis 1 and the Origin of the Earth, which we'll not do here in this PowerPoint talk. I also asked the question here, it could have been asked several places in the account, where's the reader to imagine that he or she is located? When an author writes a book or a narrative or something of that sort, the author designs it so that the reader will naturally identify in a particular with a particular character or something of that sort, and then see the thing from his or her viewpoint. So for those of you who are familiar with J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter series, most of the narrative in those books is written from the perspective of Harry Potter. Not that he's narrating it, it's not first person, but that the reader typically knows what Harry knows and doesn't know what Harry doesn't know, etc. So the question here is the reader to imagine he or she is looking over God's shoulder while God is out there creating the earth, or is the reader to imagine that he or she is located on the surface of the earth as it is formed, or even before the surface of the earth is formed, riding on what would be a piece of the surface of the earth, if you like. Verse 4, and God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. What does it mean to separate light from darkness? When we come into a room and we turn on the light, it's now light everywhere, and we turn it off, it's dark everywhere. How do you separate light from darkness? You might think of in a illuminated room and opening a closet door and walking in, and inside the room, the closet, it's dark, and outside it's a light, and the door separates the light from the darkness or something. What's meant in that kind of a phrase? Verses 5 and 6. 5, God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. We see here that God assigns the term day to this particular kind of light here, and assigns the term night to this particular kind of darkness. Light and darkness are both rather broad terms, both in Hebrew and English, and day and night are rather specific kinds of day, a specific kind of light. When the sun is shining on your side of the earth, if you like, and night when the sun is shining on the other side of the earth, if you like. Is this the first day the universe has existed? That comes back to the question of whether this starts at the very beginning of the creation of the whole universe, or whether this jumps in somewhere at the beginning of the creation of the earth. It also brings up the question, which we'll deal with a little bit later, is this the first thing as God has created? What about the invisible realm? We'll come back and talk about that by and by. Although most of your translations here in English read the first day, etc., the Hebrew actually reads one day, or day one, or possibly a first day, but not the first day. There's no definite article. And the word translated first here is not the standard Hebrew word for first. It's a standard Hebrew word for one, the cardinal number rather than the ordinal number then, though it is sometimes used in an ordinal sense where it could be translated first. Verse 6, and God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. What is this expanse here? Is a term was translated traditionally in King James as firmament, following Jerome's firmamentum in his Latin translation. traditional view way back was apparently, at least some of the early Christian commentators and even some of the Jewish commentators, that it was a dome of some sort. Liberals have continued with that idea in modern times, dismissing the science of the Bible, if you like. But evangelical interpreters have typically gone over with expanse and thinking of it then as the atmosphere or something of that sort. That's the direction I've gone in my STM thesis, the biblical teaching on the firmament, which was turned into a book later, The Biblical Firmament, Vault or Vapor, and that's available on the Amazon Kindle website as a small book. Genesis 1:7, God made the expanse and separated the waters which were under the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse, and it was so. What are these upper waters? Again, a kind of a old traditional view is that they were some kind of solid body of waters, an ocean or something of that sort, above the dome. And again, liberals have regularly gone with that in modern times. evangelicals have gone various ways. Some have seen it as a water canopy, a vapor or liquid or even an ice canopy, suggested by some, which came down at the flood. In my work on the biblical teaching on the firmament, I noted that there's a passage in Psalm 148 that suggests that whatever these things were, they were still there at David's time, and therefore not apparently the major source, the floodwaters. I've taken the term to be the atmospheric water, if you like, whether it be in the form of vapor, be in the form of droplets, or in the form of ice crystals even. they are above, above the expanse, above the firmament here, in the sense that they are supported by the atmosphere. And my thesis discusses how Hebrew uses prepositions with non-solid objects and things like the leaves are carried before the wind, even though there's obviously wind on both sides of the leaf. both going the same direction, but the side that's pushing the leaf is given the emphasis, if you like. Verse 8, God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening and the morning, the second day. What's meant by heaven here? Well, Paul speaks of third heaven, and although there are some ancient interpreters who speak of seven heavens and such, the biblical picture appears to be three heavens, so that Paul is up in the heaven where God is, the paradise. In fact, I think he uses the term in that passage. back in the dedication of the temple, Solomon speaks of heaven, the heaven of heavens, and heaven God's dwelling place, and suggests then that maybe we should understand the three uses of heaven to be where the birds are, what we today call the air or the atmosphere, where the stars are, what we would here today call outer space, if you like, and where God is, which we still use the term heaven for, the invisible realm. In that case, the expanse here would be the atmosphere, I think. Genesis 1, 9 and 10. God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. How should we understand one place? The next verse suggests that it's not talking about one sea, but actually several seas. Let's see that here. God called the dry land earth. The waters that were gathered together he called seas. God saw it was good. Notice seas, plural. So then the one place would presumably be what we think of as ocean basins or something of that sort, rather than there being one landmass and one sea at this particular point. Verse 11, let the earth sprout vegetation, the plants yielding seed, fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth. And it was so. Note that this verse, 11, and the next verse, 12, is the only reference in the account of the plants. That could mean that God created all the plants at one time, though geologic evidence would suggest that some plants are much later created and others earlier. My own read, however, here is that this is a narrative technique in which the plants are all put together because although they'll show up a couple of times being mentioned, they're not the main focus, if you like, of the account. The main focus of the account is finally to be on humans. Verse 12 goes on, the earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding fruit according to their kinds, trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. How do we understand here, according to its kind? Well, some interpreters take that to mean each of these things is created and it will reproduce according to its kind, and that's certainly a possible meaning, although it's not as strong as it would appear in the KJV translation, after its kind, because the Hebrew translated after there is just la, which means according to, and that's why ESV has done according to here. others have suggested that God created each kind of plants, okay, and doesn't say anything about how they'll reproduce, though we observe, independent of the question of evolution, that certainly over long periods of time, they reproduce the same sort of thing, though there's variety. One 13, and there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. I might point out here, I mentioned it once before, the Hebrew lacks the for days 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Doesn't show up until 6. And God says, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night. Let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. The purposes of the lights are here given in verse 14 and then also in verse 15 where it goes on to say, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth. And it was so. What does it mean that the lights are in the expanse? Does the expanse something thick and the lights are in it? In which case the expanse would presumably include outer space as well. It doesn't fit very well with the dome idea. At least most of the views we've seen in antiquity, do not view the dome as something that the lights would be inside of, but could just mean seen against it or something of that sort. So I looked up in the sky, and there in the sky was a bird, or there in the sky was the sun, or something of that sort, doesn't really tell us that it's in the sense that we think of as the fish is in the water or something. God made, verse 16, God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. Obviously, these two lights are the sun and the moon. You might wonder why they're not named. One suggestion might be this account was originally given to Adam and Eve, and these objects had no names yet. Another might be the narrator, who perhaps is Moses in that case, much later, is giving it and not going to use the names that existed in the Hebrew language at that point for sun and moon, because those had become by pagan nations around them, Canaanites and such, who spoke the same language, had become gods and goddesses. don't know the answer to that, huh? So we might ask here again the question of where are we to imagine the viewpoint of the reader to be, where does the author want the reader to be viewing these things from, so to speak. And this passage suggests from the surface of the earth, etc., where the two great lights are the sun and the moon, whereas if you get out far enough into space, the moon disappears, basically, and the sun takes its place with the other stars as kind of an average star. Why are they mentioned here in the account? This would be just before the remark about the fourth day. The traditional interpretation is they didn't exist before this time, although day and night existed before this time, and depending on how long the days are and such, you would be in trouble if the plants had to exist for a long time without the sun. It may be that if you're viewing this from the surface of the earth, that the atmosphere has been cleared of its cloudiness, and so now the sun and the moon can be seen for the first time. Verse 17, God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. A repetition, and this is fairly a standard feature of the account here, that God says, let there be this or that, and in the later remarks, these are longer things that are explained, like with the plants, and then there's a repetition that this happened, here God set them in the expanse to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, to separate the light from the darkness, and God saw that it was good. So we see of the lights here in the sky, they give light, they rule, that is, the sun dominates the day, and the moon dominates the night, and they separate light from darkness, that is, the sun does. And there was evening, and there's morning, the fourth day. We might ask here, we could ask it anywhere, does each day include all the pre-activities back to the previous day? That is, are we to understand that the whole creation period occupies just the space of these days, whether these days be literal 24-hour days, or whether these days be God's days, analogical days, if you like. We're not told, okay? A model that I have used, but I'm not dogmatic about particularly, is that the days are intermittent, and the events before the fourth day took place before the fourth day, and then the fourth day intervenes, and the next events occur between the fourth and the fifth day, etc. Verse 20, and God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures. Let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. How's this fulfilled? We're not told. You might say, God said, let the, these animals be, and poof, they were. Okay, that's a possibility. Okay. Or it tells the waters to let these things happen, and then the waters bring them forth in some way, and we'll see a similar explanation. A similar expression for let the earth bring forth, etc., with a little bit further on. So something of this sort would be open to some kind of an evolution. We're not told. And my suggestion is that we have to look at the evidence we see in nature as well as the evidence we see in Scripture, and then try to put together a best model that fits both of them. So how is this fulfilled? Not told. How quickly? Not told. Okay. Verse 21. So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, every winged bird according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. I might mention here that the term translate bird can actually be more general. It usually is bird, but occasionally it's used for insects and such. So the account here may be speaking of those things which were created to operate flying around in one way or another. God blessed them, saying, be fruitful, multiply, fill the waters of the seas, let the birds multiply on the earth, etc. First command to fill, and we'll see a couple more of those as well. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fifth day, literally day fifth, or a fifth day. And God said, verse 24, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And so we here have land animals. What does let the earth bring forth mean? Okay, same as the question about let the waters swarm back in the previous verses. Verse 25, and God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. Again, we get this repetition. Verse 26, then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens, over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And we see here humans were made to have dominion over all the animals, air animals, sea animals, land animals. What does in our image mean? The Bible nowhere says, here's what I mean by the image of God, or here's what God means by the image of God in man. And so various attempts have been made to understand that. The Mormons have argued this means God has a physical body. Well, we feel there are enough passages elsewhere in Scripture to rule that out. we have other alternatives, some kind of a spiritual image or a mental image or something. In 2 Peter, I believe it is, in the New Testament, the writer Peter speaks of irrational animals, allogos, is the term used there for irrational. And so interpreters understood it to mean that human rationality is something of God's image, and to see God, as see man as a maker like God, and one who has moral standards and morality is a feature of human nature, messed up by the fall at this point. So some suggested that. I suggested one possibility in walking through the biblical pictures that God gives us of the God-man relation. God is a potter and we're the clay. God is a farmer and we're the plant. God is a shepherd and we're the sheep. God is a king and we're his subjects. God is a master and we're his slaves. God is a parent, father usually, but not always, and we are his children. God is a husband and we are his wife, etc. And suggest that in these ways, as we are a husband or a wife or such, we image God, or we image the God-man relationship, even as owners with our pets, etc. And perhaps that's the sort of thing going on. The kind of things that humans can do in these different relationships are ways in which we image the kind of things God does. Genesis 1:27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. This is the first occurrence in the Bible of poetry, characterized by the parallel lines and repetition of terms and such. It's again a repetition. It's explaining the fulfillment of the command, let us make, or whatever you want to call that. but it suggests then that looking at the rest of Genesis 1, if it's poetry, it's not this kind of poetry. It's usually been taken to be structured prose of some sort. It does have structure, as we'll see in a bit here. Verse 28, and God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of heaven and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So we get repetition again, and we get the emphasis about filling, and we also get this remark about blessing. And God said, verse 29, "Behold, I've given you every plant yielding seed that's on the face of the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food." So humans are given plants for food. Verse 30, "And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has breath of life, I've given every green plant for food." And it was so. So are the animals apparently given plants for food. Does this mean there's no meat eating yet? Well, it doesn't quite say it. It doesn't say, "I've not given you," etc. But that's a natural way of understanding it, and that tends to favor a young earth view at this particular point, although I do not come down at that point myself. Genesis 1:31, God saw everything that he had made. Behold, it was very good, and there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Here we finally get the definite article, the, with day, first time. Comment, this ends Genesis chapter 1, but this particular creation account goes on for a few verses into chapter 2, followed by the rest of chapter 2, followed in the rest of chapter 2 by a more detailed account of the creation of humans. Some have seen this other thing in beginning in Genesis 2:4 as another creation account. I would not read it that way, but we'll postpone this discussion until we continue to consider the origin of humans. Genesis 2, 1 and 2, 1, "Thus the heavens and earth were finished, and all the host of them." So this completes the creation account. And then verse 2, "And on the seventh day God finished his work that he had done. He rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done." So there's no, "and it was evening and it was morning," the seventh day or a seventh day for this particular day. This is a passage that bothered the rabbis somewhat. Because the tradition of how they observed the Sabbath was you quit working before the seventh day. And so it should have said, "On the sixth day, God finished his work that he had done." But it doesn't say that. Genesis 2:3, "So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation." God blesses and consecrates the seventh day. What does it mean that God rested? Well, the usual understanding is that he ceases his creative activity at this particular point, not that he's tired or anything of that sort. Well, that's our tour. Let's look at some features of Genesis 1 then that, some of them we haven't mentioned so far, but have run through in looking at the passage. First of all, the account is an ordered account. The structure looks chronological. We have days, chronological term, and numbers, and except for the first of these numbers, they are sequential numbers, what we call ordinal numbers, and even the first one could be understood in that way. So the days are described using ordering numbers. Most models of interpretation see the events of the chapter, Genesis 1 and the first few verses of 2, as included within the days. A few models see the days as intermittent, with the events coming between the days. Some models see the days as a literary structure instead of a chronology. We'll say something about that in just a minute. The account has got a number of what we might call refrains, repeated phrases or sentences. "Let there be," of course, is a pretty important one. And it was so, and it was evening, and it was morning. One day, a second day, a third day, according to their kinds, be fruitful and increase, and let something or another bring forth, let the waters teem with, let the earth bring forth, etc. There's also this parallelism of days. Day 1 and day 4 appear to be parallel. Day 1, we have light, let there be light, and God separating light from darkness. And in day 4, let the lights, light bearers, we might say, be seen in the heavens, and they function to separate day and night. And we see that at least at one point the light has been identified with day and the darkness with night, so parallelism there. A parallelism of day 2 and 5. In day 2, an expanse separates the waters into waters below the expanse, what we think of surface water, and water above, which I suggested is atmospheric water rather than a vapor canopy or waters above the dome. And then in day five, we have sea life and air life. Interesting. And my suggestion then is the sea life is in the waters below, and the air life is in the expanse, and actually interacts with the waters above in the sense of clouds and such. Day three and day six, the sea is gathered and the dry land appears. And then day six, we have land life, including humans. So there basically is that parallelism. A number have suggested that parallelism is the dominant feature of the account rather than the sequential days. I find that hard to believe, and certainly the parallelism is there, okay? And my inclination is to take the parallelism and the sequence of days as both significant features of the account rather than trying to evaporate one to emphasize the other. God creates by his word. We could have even put this under refrain, and God said, and God said, and God said. So God speaks, and it happens. The account does not tell us how quickly it happens. And God decrees various things in the course of the biblical history that we see later on, and lots of them don't happen right away. God commissions Elijah to appoint a successor and to... now my mind is going blank and I've forgotten what the other things were, but they don't happen instantaneously after that. Elijah goes and appoints Elisha, and then in the course of time, Elisha and others see to it that Ahab and Jezebel are killed and such. Is there mediation? Well, one obvious mediation is God creates by his word. And in John 1:1, John takes us in a rather striking way. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, etc. And we see then that he's saying in the creation account, we not only see God creating, we see his Word active, and we see the Spirit hovering upon the waters, that we actually have a Trinitarian hints, if you like, in the creation account. Also in connection with the matter of mediation, but seen from a different perspective, is how much of this creation is ex nihilo? Nothing existed, God creates it, and now it exists. How much of it is miraculous, but using existing material, as it appears we see from God making man, but using the dust of the earth, if you like, in regard to making his body. How much of the creation is providential? And we're not told. And different views, then, take different amounts of this, and for different reasons, etc. Here's something that struck me some years ago. Where are the angels? The angels are clearly created. This is seen most obviously in Nehemiah 9:6. Where the writer here, a psalm, so to speak, you are the Lord, you alone. You have made heaven, the heaven of heavens with all their host, the earth and all that is in it, the seas and all that is in them, and you preserve all of them, and the host of heaven worships you. So we might have thought otherwise, that their host, the heaven and the heaven of heavens, their host might just be the birds and the stars, if you like, huh? But all of the host of heaven worship you, it sounds like we're talking about what we call the angels. Do we fit them into Genesis 1? Say, they weren't mentioned, but in fact they happened there. That's what the Book of Jubilees does, a work that was around in the Intertestament period, attempting to fill out Genesis in one way or another, divide up the time periods into years and weeks of years and jubilees of years and such. And they put, the author that puts the creation of the angels in the first day of Genesis, okay? Or are they a part of an earlier creation? There are two passages in the Bible that hint in this direction. One is Hebrews 9:11, and the other is Job 38:7. Let's look at those. Hebrews 9:11, But when Christ appeared as high priest to the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, the sentence goes on in verse 12, but we're not going there. we're looking at this greater and more perfect tent, the heavenly tabernacle, and we're told it's not of this creation. It doesn't say not created, which might be understood as if you just said not made with hands, but not of this creation. Does that imply there was another creation, the creation of the unseen world, if you like, from our perspective? that may well be so. And presumably then the angels would have been created in connection with that. Job 38, 6 and 7. God is questioning Job, verse 6, on what were its bases sunk, earth's bases sunk, who laid its cornerstone, when the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. So here's the sons of God already there when God is creating the earth, and they're observing, and they're rejoicing. Sounds like not only they're already around, but maybe they're not of this creation. Well, the Genesis account is brief. The account we looked at, we're not talking here yet about the creation of the detail of the creation of Adam and Eve and such, but the section we looked at is 31 verses in chapter 1, 3 verses in chapter 2, total 34 verses. Compare that with other accounts in Genesis. Cain and Abel incident, which is important perhaps as seeing the first murder, but otherwise that neither of them are our ancestors in any way, takes up 16 verses, nearly half the other. The flood, three chapters, takes up 68 verses, twice the extent of the creation account. Abraham rescues Lot takes up 24 verses. The three visitors who come to Abraham and announce that Abraham and Sarah are going to have a child, and also announce that they're going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, 33 verses. Sodom and Gomorrah destruction, on top of that, is another 38 verses. So, the account's brief. In summary, we can say that the creation account leaves much for our imaginations to fill in. It leaves out some things we would have expected to see there. So, when we've walked through the variations that we've seen and what this might mean, what that might mean, there are numerous alternatives that are consistent with the Bible's inerrancy. But only one of these is what actually happened. Which was it? That's the big question. Well, that's the end of our discussion of a quick overview of Genesis 1. But actually, it's just the beginning, and then trying to figure out how to fit this with what God has also told us in nature. So that will be for other attempts. Thank you very much for your attention.